but I can still lift her, even if it makes my still tender ribs ache. She cries into my neck, the brim of her cowboy hat cutting into my ear. My mom looks at the ceiling, hands on her hips. She taps her foot so fast, Mary Magdalene comes running over and starts whapping at her shoelaces. "Stop that," Mom says under her breath. She looks at us. "Fine." She leaves the kitchen. I can feel Meredith relax in my arms.
"Good,"
I hear her say, her voice thick.
"Can we leave now before she changes her mind again?"
"We're younger than every single parent," Mel says, looking around, "and older than every single fan." The performance space at our pitifully small county fairgrounds is an outdoor amphitheater, built next to a huge sheet metal stable where they have the livestock competitions during the fair. The biggest star that's ever performed here before now was a local girl who came in third on a TV singing competition. Bolts of Fire are playing in the domed arena in the big city tomorrow night, where there'll be approximately 8 million times as many fans. We're about 9 rows from the back, but the amphitheater is so small and deep, dug partially into the ground, that there really isn't a bad seat. There are actually fewer parents than I expected, though it's also possible they're commiserating with each other at the coffee bars before the actual music starts. Mostly, it's just little girls. More than you've ever seen. More than you would think could possibly fit into a small county fair amphitheater. So many, it's like space and time folded together, and every little girl who ever lived will arrive eventually.
"Do you see any of your friends?" I ask Meredith.
"Bonnie isn't coming,"
she answers. Bonnie is the other girl in her grade who takes all the insane extra tutoring that Meredith does. They have jazz and tap together. Bonnie's mom is the meanest person I've ever met in my entire life.
"Anyone else?"
Meredith doesn't say anything, just keeps looking around. I begin to wonder if there is anyone for Meredith besides Bonnie. God, poor Meredith.
"You don't have to sing along," Meredith tells us, "but I'm going to. Just don't make fun of anything."
"We won't, Mared Breath," Mel says.
"And don't call me that."
"Where's the cancer girl?" I say, trying to see if they've roped off a VIP pit somewhere down front.
"She's called Carly," Meredith informs me very seriously. "Our thoughts and prayers are with her."
"I heard these tickets were going for $3,000 on the internet," I say.
"No true fan would do that," Meredith yells. "And it was fan club members only, and you had to prove that you lived here, and everyone had to show ID at the gate."
She has a point there. It was like getting on an international flight with the president just to get inside. And that was after the half hour it took to get through the rows and rows and rows of TV news vans and journalists covering the story. We kept hearing reporters say, "This little middle of nowhere," as we passed. Which, yeah, I also say a lot, but it's different when I say it.
"Anyone want a pop or something?" Mel asks.
"No,"
Meredith says, horrified.
"It's going to start in 5 minutes.
"Oh, please," Mel says.
"Concerts never start on..."
"Ladies and gentlemen," the loudspeakers announce, "please take your seats, as the Bolts of Fire concert will start in 5 minutes.
There's a deafening scream from around the amphitheater that happens at about the height of my ribcage. Little girls jump up and down and hug each other and go crazy and are just otherwise disturbingly hysterical, while their parents start streaming in from the side, holding, yep, cups of coffee. No alcohol for adult prisoners of Bolts of Fire.
"That's it?"
Mel asks, having to shout over the whoops and hollers.
"A 5-minute announcement? No opening act? No music and lights to warm up the crowd?"
"If the crowd were any warmer," I shout back, "we'd need paramedics."
Somehow, a group of voices singing Bold Sapphire has emerged from the sound avalanche, and more of the girl crowd joins in, including Meredith. "I broke Bold Sapphire's heart on the day she turned 18. I never meant to do it, and I hope she still loves me." Within seconds, the amphitheater is one loud, off-key, but really enthusiastic voice singing the band's biggest hit. Which, I admit, is kinda catchy.
"Are you singing?"
Mel says to me, eyes wide. "No," I say, too fast.
The amphitheater lights go down, which is ridiculous as it's still daylight, but never mind. 1,800 little girls burst into simultaneous, overwhelmed tears. I think my eardrums are about to explode. Meredith, though, is practically levitating. She's between me and Mel, and she's so excited she doesn't know whether to hold our hands or clasp her own or just stand there and hyperventilate. She tries to do all three, which basically makes her like every girl here. She looks up at me, tears in her eyes.
I'm so happy. They're not even on yet.
She just cries some more. The screams get even louder as someone comes on stage, but they drop respectfully quickly as we all see it's a girl in a big deal hospital wheelchair being brought on by what I'm guessing is her mother and a nurse. The girl's got an oxygen tank with her and looks really bad. The non-nurse slash possible mother takes the microphone that's center stage.
Hi, everyone, she says. I'm Carly's mom.
There's another huge scream.
Thank you, she says. Carly has something she'd like to say to you.
The audience quiets down. Every girl there is pulled as taut as a bow to listen to Carly. I hear a girl behind me say mournfully, I wish I had cancer. Carly's mom brings the microphone over to Carly. We can hear her ragged breathing for several beats before she says anything.
Yikes, Mel mouths to me with a sad look. Would you?
Carly says. Breath, breath.
Please?
Breath, breath.
Welcome.
Breath, breath.
Bolts?
That's all she gets out because the audience screams like they're watching their families be murdered in front of them. Bolts of fire are walking on stage. There are five of them. They've got names. I could probably tell you what they are if I search my memory, but how can it matter? The noise in here is so bad my phone is vibrating even though it's not ringing. Mel has her fingers firmly in her ears, and I can see a father in the row in front of us sympathetically pointing to the earplugs he's wearing. The Bolts of Fire guys, all in fashionable stubble with fashionable lopsided hair that manages to weirdly suggest that they're both 30 years old and 15 years old, at the same time, bask in the applause for a minute, then gesture for the audience to quiet down. This takes a while, and even then it's only relatively. The dark-haired one who does most of the singing talks anyway.
Thank you all so much,
he says. Another skull-fracturing roar.
Ready for a good time, people of...
And then he names not our little town, but the larger town about an hour away. The audience roars anyway. Mel shoots me an irritated look, but I can't hear a word she says.
We're here today,
says the blonde one who doesn't sing very much, but who's prettier than the others,
for one special Bolts of Fire fan.
Another roar as they put a Bolts of Fire cowboy hat on Carly's head.
We're going to start,
says the one whose voice you can always tell is modified by computer to make him hit the right notes,
with Carly's favorite song.
Maybe you know this one,
says the main singer. He sings an ooh and holds it, the others joining in one at a time. I look at Meredith. She's pretty much tearing her shirt in ecstatic weeping. I put an arm around her and she leans into me, holding on like I'm comforting her at a funeral. Then, Bolts of Fire, all together a cappella surrounding poor Carly in her wheelchair.
I broke Bolt Sapphire's heart on the day she turned 18.
And the scream from the crowd is so loud that it takes a second before we realize that a bomb has gone off. At first, we all assume it's some kind of bizarrely timed fireworks from behind the stage. But then pieces of the stage set and burning curtain come flying straight at us. Bolts of fire have been knocked to the ground, and Carly's mom and nurse have wrapped themselves around Carly's body to protect her. As the debris starts falling, fortunately, it seems to be mostly styrofoam and cheap fabric. The screaming of the audience changes so much, you can feel it in your body. A rising terror that seems to come out of the ground like a flood of water, rising up to choke you before you even start to swim. We are in the most incredible danger.
I pick Meredith up immediately, knocking her hat to the floor. She's so scared she doesn't even mention it. I'm so scared I don't even notice my ribs.
Mel presses herself against us, arms wrapping around me and Meredith.
What was that?
Mel screams.
We've got to get out of here,
I scream back.
They're coming,
Meredith yells, and we turn down to the rows in front of us. A tidal wave of panicked parents and panicked little girls is flowing over the seats up the wall of the amphitheater, coming right at us. There's no time to even think. I turn with Meredith in my arms and we run. I climb up over row after row, the seats above us quickly vacating, thank God. Mel is behind us, shielding Meredith from any more debris. I see a few bloody faces as we rush on, and I can only wonder if there's anyone really badly hurt. But there's no time for that as I keep climbing. We get stuck behind a frantic mom, trying to herd three girls in front of her. Without breaking stride, Mel picks one of the girls up. The mom, with what seems to be superhuman strength, picks up the other two, and we all climb together, as that's still faster than the clogged aisles. We're lucky by a factor of 1,000 that the biggest exits are at the back of the amphitheater, wide staircases heading down into the green fields of the fairgrounds. Me and Mel and the woman reach the top of one and scramble down the steps, only just barely able to stay standing in the rush of people.
There!
Mel yells, and starts heading toward a bit of the fairgrounds that have been left wooded, with a clearing in the middle for picnics and barbecues. Most of the crowd pour out past the confused news crews to the parking lot, but we swerve to the side with some others finally stopping in the trees, huddling together. Mel puts down the girl she picked up, and the mom hugs her in with the other two, saying,
"Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you,"
to Mel. I set Meredith down, and she instantly throws up. My adrenaline is so high, my hands are shaking uncontrollably, but I do my best to rub her on the back.
"It's okay, Meredith. We're out, and we're going home right now."
"Mikey," Mel says,
"look."
Hovering over the amphitheater, against the now setting sun, a pillar of blue light is disappearing from where the explosion was.
"It wasn't a bomb," Mel says. "It was them, whoever the hell they are."
In the past, there's been collateral damage from whatever the indie kids are involved in. But it's hard to think of collateral damage when it's me and Mel and freaking Meredith and almost 2,000 little girls. Whatever it is has just gotten worse. A lot worse.
"Aren't you Alice Mitchell's daughter?"
we hear. Cynthia, the bitter little blogger who's always attacking my mother and who tried to drag Mel's past into the press conference, is standing in the clearing, pad in her hand, filming us.
"You are, aren't you? The anorexic one."
Another camera crew from the big city affiliate has seen her and is rushing over to us as well, trying to find someone who'll tell them what happened.
"Where's your mother?" Cynthia sneers at my sister. "Why isn't she here to protect her children?"
Mel barely hesitates. She steps forward, snatches the pad out of Cynthia's hands, and punches her right across the face. Chapter the 15th, in which the prince explains to Satchel that the immortal crux that allows passage between worlds depends on the amulets. The one she wears is missing from it, and though it protects her, its absence is causing holes to rip in the boundaries between the immortal's world and hers, the life force. "You would see it as a kind of blue light, but it would burn you, Satchel. It would burn you right through." Is spilling out and causing damage, including the accident at the amphitheater that killed Satchel's friend Madison. "Should I give it back?" Satchel asks, wanting to save lives. But giving it back would fully power the immortal crux, and only make the march of the immortals into her world unstoppable. It's an impossible dilemma. B. The police are saying a gas main exploded. A gas main. The only person who died was an indie kid called Madison who was in calc with me and Jared. I spoke to her a bunch of times in class. She was definitely not stupid, but they say she was smoking outside the amphitheater after dropping off her sister at the concert, and it ignited a leaky gas main. Bullshit. First of all, why does a teeny tiny amphitheater in the middle of a field at the state's smallest county fair have a gas main running right behind its only stage? Second of all, Madison used an inhaler, so totally didn't smoke. Third of all, bull and shit. Lots of people were hurt, including bolts of fire. So the rest of the entire world hates our little town now. Plus, Carly's mom and nurse. No one very badly, though. Four of five bolts of fire still performed bravely the next night in the big city, while the blonde one got his front teeth replaced. Carly didn't get hurt at all, which is one small blessing. One very small blessing if that's all you've got when you have terminal cancer and the concert of your dreams is blown up. Meredith got treated for shock at the scene by Call Me Steve, who was the first person Mel phoned. He showed up in an ambulance, saw to Meredith, kissed Mel really hard, then ran off to help other people. I like him. Our mom just cried. Genuinely, I'll give her that, and for all of us too, not just Meredith. That someone could do this, she choked out in front of a bunch of journalists when people still thought it was a bomb. In a place where my children are. But she hugged us. I thought she'd never stop. You're sure you're not hurt? You're sure? Just a little freaked out, Mel said. More than a little, actually. And our mom hugged us again. She didn't even yell at us for not letting her come along to the concert to be exploded herself. Quite a few news crews ended up getting footage of Mel attacking Cynthia. So far, it's actually helped my mom's campaign. I thought it was a terrorist attack, Mel told the cameras, keeping a straight face that I'll remember with joy until I die. And suddenly here was someone identifying me as a politician's daughter. I thought I was a target. So I protected my younger brother and sister. There will be no charges filed, not even for the pad Cynthia was using, which Mel perhaps unnecessarily broke in two by stomping on it. Cynthia blogged about it all. I don't think anyone cared. Bet that was pretty awful, huh, Mared Breath? Jared says, squeezing the life out of her, her little bare toes 3 feet off the ground. Uh-huh, Meredith says, muffled into his neck. And don't call me that. He sets her down, hands on her shoulders, and looks her in the eye. They just stare at each other for a minute, then she smiles. Your hands are getting hot, she says, but I'm okay. He smiles back at her. You sure? She nods. But show me the lights anyway. He checks to make sure my parents aren't watching, which is for show, as we all know they're both out of the house, or he wouldn't even be here. Then pulls his hand slightly away, casting a light down her arms from the palms of his hands. She giggles and throws her arms around his enormous legs in a last hug. She slept in Mel's bed the past 2 nights since the explosion. I can't blame her, and I don't think Mel's in any hurry to get her out either. None of us have been back to school yet, but I think today is pushing it. It's not actually that much fun missing school when there's so little of it left. Did you actually do anything for her? I ask as Meredith heads into the kitchen to make herself a snack, always keeping us in sight. I don't know, Jared says. I was feeling all these good things for her, all my hopes that she wasn't hurt. He flexes his hands. Maybe some of that got into her. Are you getting more powerful? I ask. Is that something that would even happen? He just frowns and flops down on the sofa. Mary Magdalene sits on the arm of it, watching him, purring and kneading her paws into the fabric. You take good care of Meredith, okay? Jared whispers to her, touching her lightly on the nose. The cat immediately jumps off the couch and starts following Meredith around the kitchen. Gas main, huh? He says to me. Don't get me started, I say, sitting down next to him. The question is, what are we going to do about it? What can we do about it? We don't know what's going on. Come on, Jared, surely the gods must know something. Mikey, it doesn't work like that. Don't you think I'd be finding out if I could? Finding out what? Meredith says, scooching up on the couch next to Jared, with a plate of cheese and crackers, Mary Magdalene sitting firmly on her feet.
Finding out what's really going on, Bite says, Jared says, not lying to her either.
Meredith nods seriously. There's still hardly anything on the internet. Rumors and theories and indie kids disappearing. But mostly it's just people monstering other people for thinking it's vampires again, or for not thinking it's vampires again. Everyone thinks they know better. Everyone.
She eats a cracker.
I think I'm going to give away all my Bolts of Fire stuff.
I think I'd want to, too, Jared says. You're sure you're okay? He asks me later, driving us to work after Mel came home from her day out with Call Me Steve.
I could have called in sick, but I was getting antsy just sitting around the house. It felt like I was waiting for something to happen, which has to be the worst part of being young. So many of your decisions aren't yours. They're made by other people. Sometimes they're made badly by other people. Sometimes they're made by other people who have no idea what the consequences of those decisions might be. The bastards.
I'm fine, I say. You're not. I spent an hour brushing my teeth this morning because every time felt like I hadn't done it right. Mel finally noticed and got me out of it. See?
Jared, we have to do something. Make the indie kids tell us what they know. Or Nathan.
Jesus, Mike, would you leave him alone? I told you, he was with me and Henna at the movies.
He could still have some part in it. I don't trust him. Why was he in the field that time? What's he doing hanging around my house in the dark?
His mom is like the saddest person in the world. I told him we hung around the field, so maybe he just needed a place to get away. You're getting obsessive.
Of course I am. Have you met me? They could have killed my sisters, Jared. It could have happened right there in front of me.
And you, Jared says more softly. They could have killed you too.
I look at him, then back out the windshield of his tiny car. Thanks, man.
Look, what do we know? He says. We know that only one person died.
An indie kid.
Yes, an indie kid. A nice one, who was smart and good at math. She didn't deserve that, none of them did.
Unless they're the ones who stirred all this up.
Even then, Jared says sternly. And come on, have you seen them lately? They're even more scared than the rest of us, and with good reason.
I don't say anything, but he's probably right about that.
And what I did find out from my grandmother...
You talked to your grandmother? I thought she was off in her realms, unreachable.
It wasn't easy. In fact, it was a huge giant pain in my ass, but what I did find out is that when it happened before, because she was there once, remember? This kind of big public thing meant the beginning of the end.
I wait for him to continue.
What end?
He shrugs. However it's going to be solved. However the indie kids are going to solve it.
If they solve it.
They always have.
Doesn't mean they always will. Doesn't mean people won't get hurt before they do. Doesn't mean more people won't die.
Jared pulls into a spot in the Griller's parking lot.
We may never find out what's actually going on, Mike. It may all end with us not seeing anything else.
But Jared...
Listen to me, he says, sounding angry. We've got prom, we've got graduation, we've got the summer. Then everything changes. Are you going to live all that time until we go, afraid?
Probably.
Please don't.
He's still weirdly angry.
Not everyone has to be the chosen one. Not everyone has to be the guy who saves the world. Most people just have to live their lives the best they can, doing the things that are great for them. Having great friends, trying to make their lives better, loving people properly. All the while knowing that the world makes no sense, but trying to find a way to be happy anyway.
He's gripping the steering wheel hard. And I can see light flashing from his palms.
What aren't you telling me? I ask. What's going on?
He just sighs, and the light dims.
I don't know what's going on. I don't know about the cops or the pillars of light, or what the indie kids have got themselves mixed up in, but I do know this. One, they better not blow up the high school before we graduate, and two,
he holds up his palms again. They flash a little with faint light.
If anyone I care about is put in harm's way again, there's going to be holy hell to pay. Literally.
And that makes me feel a little bit better.
Our shift is crazy. Tina has to be out on the floor full-time, waiting tables herself, even on what should be a slow weeknight. It's like the town knows something's happening and doesn't want to be alone either. Mel and Henna bring in Meredith, who sits in my section this time. I take them enough cheesy toast to feed a cheesy toast-loving sperm whale. "How's the tat?" I ask Henna, who answers by hugging me.
"It itches," she says in my ear. Then she leans back and looks at me.
"What?"
I ask. "Just you, saving people."
"So you're not mad at me anymore?"
"Who cares about mad?" she says.
"No Nathan tonight?" I can't help myself from asking. She frowns and slides in next to Meredith, who's already got cheesy toast butter on her face. We're so busy, that's all I can really talk to them right then. I bring cheeseburgers for Henna and Meredith, and a chicken salad for Mel, who digs in like she's famished. I notice slightly too long. She makes a face. They're still there half an hour later when something completely unexpected happens for the second time this week. It's not a bomb this time, even if it might as well be. My dad shows up.
"Dad?"
I say, so surprised I stop right there, at the entrance where Tina is wrangling with menus trying to seat people. There's a line of customers waiting to get in, which usually only happens on Sunday mornings after all the church is let out. My dad's at the front of the line, looking around, slightly stunned, but not smelling of booze that I can tell.
"Busy tonight, huh?"
he says.
"What are you doing here?"
He fingers his collar, only catching my eye in brief little glances.
"Meeting your mother. Is she here?"
"You're meeting her here? At the restaurant?" My surprise must finally sink in because he stops, seeming confused.
"I think so,"
he says, and it's almost a question. I say because I really don't know what else to say. Tina finally can't take it anymore.
"Are you busy?"
she says to me, eyes wide, voice high.
"Because I am."
I snap out of it. "Dad, Mel and Meredith are sitting over there with Henna." I point. Three astonished, frozen faces stare back at us from their booth.
"Why don't you, you know, sit with them?"
My dad nods, but doesn't head over to the booth.
"Can I talk to you for a sec?"
he asks me. Without even looking at her, I hand the coffee pots I'm holding to a really very angry now Tina and follow my dad out into the parking lot. It's only just getting dark. The rain let off the week before the Bolts of Fire concert, and you can tell that summer might actually be on the way, if we live to see it. My dad scrunches up his face like his mind's elsewhere and pulls again at his collar.
"Why don't you take your tie off?" I ask.
"Hmm?"
he says. He doesn't touch the tie. He looks at the moon, up already, only about half full.
"When I was your age, we really did think we'd be living up there by now."
I wait. He doesn't continue.
"I'm kind of busy, Dad. What's up?"
He scratches his ear. I think for a second that he's not steady on his feet, but then I realize he's just shuffling around, not staying still. I lean in and smell him again. He gives me a small grin.
"Nope,"
he says.
"Sober."
"Well," I say, "that's good."
"Listen," he starts, but again doesn't finish. "Dad, seriously, I'm going to go into rehab."
He stops because a family has come out of the restaurant. Tina leans out the door behind them, looking at me with furious eyes. I flash a 1-minute index finger at her, and she goes back inside.
I say, "That's great, Dad. Not until after the election, but I'm going to go."
I frown.
"I think you're a bit more important than..."
"Not her idea, though she's been asking for years, hasn't she?"
"I wouldn't know, Dad, but even so, I think she'd probably..."
"Don't want to ruin her big moment."
He fidgets some more, catching my eye and looking away. I lean closer.
"Dad?
Dad, look at me."
He hesitates,
then looks at me full on. Even in the dusk, I can see that his pupils are pretty much the size of dinner plates.
What have you taken? Valium? Something prescription?
I'm fine, he says, straightening up. I've just got to make it to the election, and then I'll go into rehab, and we'll all be a family again.
I'll be living two states away.
He slumps a bit. Yeah, I knew that.
What are you doing here, Dad? Are you really meeting Mom? Or did you drag me out of the busiest night of the year just so you could tell me you're going to rehab in 6 months?
He frowns again, looking back up at the moon. There were going to be cities up there. No poverty, no war. That's how it was supposed to be. Okay, I've got to go. I'll get Mel to drive you home. I need to borrow some money, he blurts out.
Well, that stops me. You what?
He sighs. The campaign didn't think it was a good idea for me to have full access to the accounts. He shrugs, like he can't blame them. I'm short of cash. I don't want to ask your mother.
I don't know what to say. What can I say? I'm not even angry at him. Just so sad I can barely look him in the face. I take out every tip I've collected that evening and hand him the whole wad of cash.
Thanks. Go wait in your car, I interrupt, still not looking at him. Do not drive it. I turn my back on him. As my dad lurches into the parking lot, I step into the entryway of the restaurant, grabbing the front door handle. A small red light catches the corner of my eye. I look over. Behind some bushes, in the shadows, Nathan smoking.
I'm sorry, he says quickly. I saw you talking to him, and I was going to say hello, but then...
He doesn't finish, but I know. He was going to say hello, but then he heard my dad being embarrassing and tragic, and he got stuck there, not wanting to alert us to his presence by going either backward or forward.
How much did you hear? I say, heat in my voice.
Mike, I can't believe you smoke, I say. It's disgusting. It stinks. You get breath like a dog. And it won't kill you fast enough.
It was an accident, Mike, I swear.
My chest is burning, like it's being squeezed in a molten vise.
I've got to get back to work.
I don't look at him once the rest of the night, even though he sits with Henna after Mel takes Meredith and my dad home. At the waitress station, Tina uses every opportunity to shout at me, but I don't listen to her. I'm too busy repeatedly counting ketchup bottles and wishing I was dead, wishing I was dead, wishing I was dead, wishing I was dead.
Chapter the 16th, in which Satchel cries in her room, taking the blame for all her friends' deaths, even though everyone she knows assures her that it's not her fault. Dylan knocks on her window. He comforts her, finally kissing her. She stops him, says she understands his desire for her, but she'll have to break his heart. They're surprised by a knock at the front door. Her mother yells up that it's second indie kid Finn. Dylan looks surprisingly serious and asks, "How do we know we can trust him?"
B.
Hey, Dr. Luther.
It's good to see you again, Michael.
Is it? Doesn't that mean you failed last time, though?
Still concerned about failure, I see.
I know. Why does everything have to be something you win or lose?
Do you know?
I thought I did.
I should tell you up front that your mom's been talking to me.
As a patient?
No, but don't sound so shocked. She's been talking to me as your mother. As your concerned mother. She told me things have been challenging for you lately. It's only fair that you know that. I won't, of course, tell her anything that we discuss here, though. That's between us.
Did she tell you she's campaigning again?
She did. How do you feel about that?
It's weird.
How so?
It's like it doesn't have anything to do with me this time. Like, our lives have already separated, and this is something that's happening to her rather than to us. Plus, she's being okay about it, actually.
That's a generous thing for you to say.
It's true. Mel's been kept out of it except for at the concert. Did you see that?
I did. That was so great. She was so great. She couldn't have done that last time.
That's good to hear. There was always a lot of strength in your sister. But we are not talking about her, are we?
No, I guess we're not.
Tell me what's been happening, Michael. Tell me why you've come back to see me.
I thought my mom already told you.
I want to hear it from you.
I've been getting stuck in loops. Again. Like, I can't leave the house unless I lock the door a certain way, but I don't really know what that certain way is, or how there are even supposed to be different ways to lock a front door. It happens a lot when I'm washing myself, too, if I don't do it in just the right order. Or if I start to touch things and count them, I can just get stuck there.
What do you think will happen if you don't do these things?
I don't know. Something awful? Something I won't be able to handle? Everything will fall apart.
Everything?
I don't know.
Is it something to do with the spate of deaths at your school?
What do you know about those?
They're not unknown. They've happened before. It's one of the more terrible sociological phenomena.
Do you know what's causing them?
Cause? They were accidents and suicides, as far as I understand.
Is there an underlying cause? No.
No, I guess not. Unless you mean it's something like the vampires or the soul-eating ghosts. Don't look so surprised. We had armies of the undead when I was your age. It was pretty awful and scary, but it was confined, kept quiet, involving a fairly small group of people, while the adult world looked on obliviously.
I don't know what to say about any of that.
Does this time around have anything to do with you?
I'm not an indie kid.
No.
But we were at the concert, and Henna and I hit that deer, and other stuff.
That I probably wouldn't believe, even after what I've said.
Maybe.
Well, I don't need to. As long as you do, it's an important thing to talk about.
Jared said we can't all be the chosen one. In fact, hardly any of us can.
Jared is still your best friend?
You've got a good memory.
I take good notes.
Yeah, my best friend. He looks after me. He saves me from these loops sometimes. He's more than my best friend, really.
You love him?
Yeah, but not like that, I don't think. He's gay, but it's different. It's like he's my family, except better, because I've chosen him.
I understand. He's important for your feeling of safety in the world.
Well, yeah. And I don't know what I'm going to do when everything changes.
Graduating, you mean?
And going off to college. It's not just Jared. Mel's going across the country. We're leaving Meredith on her own.
These are normal fears. It would be unusual if you didn't feel them.
Yeah, but...
But? I don't know if I'm going to make it. Make it how? Michael?
You're the only person who calls me Michael.
Make it how?
It's okay. It's not, though.
I mean, you're safe here. If you need to cry, you can.
It's not okay.
How is it not?
They don't need me.
Not like you need them.
No, Jared said he thought I always made myself the least wanted person in the group, but he told me that wasn't true.
You didn't believe him.
If you have to have someone tell it to you, how can it be true? How can you not just be the damaged one who needs reassurance all the time?
Don't we all need reassurance? Aren't we all damaged in some way?
You don't understand.
Then help me. I want to.
Look, they've all got other lives. Jared's got all this family stuff. Mel's dating a doctor. Hannah's going to Africa. And what do I have? I have them. I don't have anything else.
And that makes you feel like you matter the least.
Yeah. And I'm in these loops, and I'm trapped, and I can feel that I'm trapped, and getting out of them is as simple as just doing something else. Anything. But it's getting harder and harder to get out of them myself, and what if I go away and start a new life, and I get trapped in one, and I can't get out of it?
Okay, what if that does happen?
Michael? I can't say it, it's embarrassing.
I am impossible to embarrass. Tell me, Michael, what if you get trapped in a loop and can't get out?
I'll kill myself.
That's a very final choice.
It's better than being afraid forever. It's better than always being afraid.
Those are the only alternatives? Being afraid or being gone?
That's what it feels like. And I don't know what to do.
About what?
About everything.
Isn't that the problem, though? Isn't that what's causing the fear? Why do you have to solve everything? Why can't you just solve today?
I can't even do that!
You can, and you have. You're facing one of the biggest life changes anyone ever has to face. Leaving school and going out on your own. Yet you've survived a car accident that you might not have and helped your badly hurt friend. You suffered a traumatic event at that concert, but look how you acted in saving your little sister.
Mom told you all that.
She thinks very highly of you, Michael. She worries about you.
Then she should tell me. Please don't defend her.
All right. I'm just saying that you have solved a lot. You feel like you can't face anything, that it'll crush you, but you're here, in this room. All those things you're facing, and you still said to someone, said to your mother no less, who I know you don't regard as a natural ally, that you needed help. Doesn't that sound like someone who's looking for solutions?
Maybe.
I'm going to ask you a question. What if everything did fall apart? What then?
I don't understand.
If you didn't do these things, if you stepped out of the loop before finishing it the right way, what would happen? Would you survive it?
I don't know. That's kind of the whole deal.
Let me ask the question another way, then. Haven't you already survived everything falling apart?
What?
Melinda nearly died.
She did die.
Either way, if that's not everything falling apart, then what is?
I don't want it to happen again, though.
You said yourself she was doing great.
But Meredith is...
You're responsible for Meredith, too? Everything fell apart at that concert, and you all survived that. If I were to ask Melinda whether you were the least wanted, I doubt she'd answer like you have. Meredith, too. And I would bet money that your friend Jared would say the same.
They're just being nice.
All of them. All the time.
Because I'm the broken one.
Is that true? Is that really true? You said they all have other stuff to deal with. I know exactly the difficulties your sister has faced, for example.
Yeah, but she's doing better now.
Perfectly?
Well, no.
But you're measuring yourself against her.
Why are you coming at me so much?
I'm sorry, I don't mean to. I'm only trying to say that there might be other ways of looking at things. Ways that don't make you so afraid. Ways that don't make you wish you were dead. Do you cry a lot when you're on your own?
Almost never.
Then obviously you need to, Michael. It's okay. There are some tissues there if you need them.
I feel like I'm at the bottom of a well. I feel like I'm way down this deep, deep hole, and I'm looking up, and all there is this little dot of light, and I have to shout at the top of my lungs for anyone to hear me, and even when I do, I say the wrong thing. Or they don't really listen, or they're just humoring me.
Because they couldn't possibly care about you.
It's hard to feel that. They tell me. They show me. And I still don't feel it.
Why do you think that is?
The fear gets in the way, and I get stuck in a loop.
Because if you can just get the loop right.
Yes. If I can just get it right, it'll all be okay. I'll save everyone. And the world won't fall apart. And it's getting harder to do.
I bet it is. All the stuff that's going on for you.
All the stuff that will always go on.
That's probably true, too.
Can I tell you something, Dr. Luther?
Yes.
You won't laugh?
I won't.
I hate myself. I feel like an idiot saying it because blah blah teen angst, boo-hoo, but I do. I hate myself. Almost all the time. I try not to tell anyone because I don't want to burden them, but I feel like I'm falling farther and farther away from them. Like the well's getting deeper and I'm running out of energy to climb it, and any minute now, any second, it's going to stop being worth even trying.
I won't keep harping on this, but I will say again, just gently, because it's true. You're here. and that's trying. Can you help me?
Yes. For now, as a start, I'd like to put you on some medication. Why are you making that face?
Medication.
Medication is a failure?
The biggest one. Like, I'm so broken I need medical help.
Cancer patients don't call chemotherapy a failure. Diabetics don't call insulin a failure.
This is different and you know it.
I don't know it. Why is it different?
Because it means I'm crazy. Crazy is different.
Michael, do you think cancer is a moral failing?
What kind of cancer?
Don't play. You know what I mean. Do you think a woman who gets ovarian cancer is morally responsible for it?
No.
Do you think a child born with spina bifida or cerebral palsy or muscular dystrophy is at fault for their condition?
No, but...
Then why in heaven's name are you responsible for your anxiety?
Because... What?
Why are you responsible for your anxiety?
Because it's a feeling, not a tumor.
Are you sure?
You think I have a tumor?
No. Not what I meant. A feeling is pride in your sister. A feeling is fear at the concert that makes you act. A feeling is embarrassment or shame. A feeling may or may not be true, but you still feel it.
And anxiety is a tumor on your feelings?
Feelings don't try to kill you, even the painful ones. Anxiety is a feeling grown too large, a feeling grown aggressive and dangerous. You're responsible for its consequences. You're responsible for treating it. But Michael, you're not responsible for causing it. You're not morally at fault for it. No more than you would be for a tumor.
You realize I'm now going to obsess about having a tumor.
I'm sorry, ill-chosen words. But if you're going to obsess about something, obsess about your obsession being a treatable disorder. Obsess about it not being a failure of something you've done or something you didn't do, or some intrinsic value as a person that you fail to have. Medication will address the anxiety, not get rid of it, but reduce it to a manageable level, maybe even the same level as other people, so that... And here's the key thing. We can talk about it. Make it something you can live with. You still have work to do, but the medication lets you stay alive long enough to do that work. Michael, isn't it possible to think of this as a success?
I never wanted to go back on it.
You told me just now, just today, that you'd rather be dead than have to go through this much longer. I take that seriously. I don't think your suffering is fake. I don't think these feelings about wanting it to end are fake. I don't think your self-hatred is fake. So why do you think it's fake?
I don't.
Don't you? Doesn't a part of you think you're making a big deal out of not very much? That if you were somehow not so weak, you could be happy and free just like everyone else?
Kind of.
You came to me because you wanted my help, yes?
Yes.
Then here's my help. One, your anxiety is a genuine and very painful problem, not one you're making up. Two, you're not morally responsible for causing it. It's nothing you did or failed to do that makes it happen. Three, medication will help treat it so that four, you and I can talk about ways to help make life bearable, even livable.
Will I have to be on it forever?
Not if you don't want to. The decisions are entirely yours.
I hate myself, Dr. Luther.
But not so much that you didn't come asking for help.
Chapter the 17th, in which Satchel doesn't know who to trust, so she follows her police officer uncle to see if she can find the source of the blue energy on her own. She enters the basement of the high school while the prom, which Satchel is completely not interested in, except in an ironic way, is going on above. While the music plays and people dance, she stops her uncle from opening a fissure that will swallow the whole gym and everyone in it. She knocks off his unattached head in the process, and the blue light fades from his body. She weeps at her actions and bravery, but the prince arrives, terrified, saying they have to run. as fast as possible.
B. You look amazing, I tell Hannah at her door on the night of the prom.
Thanks,
she says shyly.
I kind of know I look amazing. How weird is that?
Her dress is, I guess, custard and burgundy, but that really doesn't begin to describe it. Most prom dresses I've seen are either puffy to the point of cloudiness, or cut so short and sheer you keep wondering if the girl is cold.
But Hannah.
There are no gimmicks with her dress, but then there never are with her. She isn't trying to be ridiculously fashionable, but she's not ridiculously old-fashioned either. She looks like a grown-up. That's what it is. A really beautiful, beautiful, serious, and beautiful grown-up. Even the cast on her arm looks like she got it from lifting a car off a refugee child.
You look amazing, I say again. I mean it.
You're not so bad yourself.
I'm just in a tux. But okay, maybe I do look good in a tux.
Very handsome, her father says, coming up behind Hannah with her mother.
Hello, Mike, her mother says.
She holds up her phone. Picture? Yeah, I say, and Hannah slides up next to me while her mom snaps us. We look for all the world like we're going to the prom as dates, which is what her mom and dad think. They also think she's staying over with just Mel out at the cabin as a kind of we've-almost-graduated treat. They have to know Hannah's not that boring, don't they? They must know that the rest of us are going out there, too, and maybe just this once they're overlooking it? Or maybe in Finland this is perfectly normal, even for the devout.
Have a good time, her mom says, kissing her on the cheek. Her dad does the same.
They've always been this formal, like royalty, solemn in a way that makes everyone else feel slightly ridiculous. They stand together, his arm around her shoulders, watching Hannah take me by the elbow and walk down to the waiting limousine.
Oh my God,
Hannah says, seeing it. I know.
The limousine turned out to not quite be what we ordered. Those were all out, it seems, to other prom nights, maybe even at our own school. So despite a regular black limo being available when we made the booking and paid for the non-refundable deposit, that's not what showed up at my house to pick up me and Mel. I texted the others to warn them, but that still doesn't prepare you for seeing it in person.
It's a Hummer limousine. A yellow Hummer limousine.
It's horrible, Hannah says admiringly. So horrible, it's kind of wonderful.
I told you. Mel leans out its open door.
At the very least, she says, you feel safe in it.
And we do. This is probably how tanks feel. We pick up Jared next. Mr. Sherman, horrified. How much gas mileage does this thing get? Then, because everyone else wants it, Nathan. You can't smoke in here, I say before he even sits down. Call Me Steve declined a limo pickup. Already feel weird going to a prom 7 years after I graduated, he told Mel.
And so you should, Mel told him back. But you're coming anyway.
He's at the school waiting for us, opening the door so Mel can get out first. He pins on her corsage. As the only couple officially on a date tonight, he's the only one who thought of buying one, and says, this vehicle is a crime.
Against nature? Mel asks.
Against judgment, he says. Against taste, against good sense, against the planet. They walk off toward our high school gym, arm in arm, still smiling, still talking about the wonderfully horrible Hummer limo that's already gathering a small crowd of other arriving couples. Jared, huge in a tuxedo slightly too small, says, don't we all look amazing?
Yes, Hannah says. Yes, we do.
The theme of our prom is forever young. I know. We can't afford to have it in a hotel in the big city, which is what most schools do, so we're stuck with it at our own gym. Usually, you have a formal dinner beforehand with your dates, but as Grillers is the nicest restaurant in our little town, we decided to just skip that. Mr. Sherman says he's stocked up a bunch of food at the lake, so as long as that hasn't been eaten by otters or marmots or bears, we'll be fine.
Dance,
Henna commands, taking me by the elbow again. Me first? I say, following her out to the dance floor. It's a slow dance, so I put my hands on her hips, and she rests the non-cast hand on my shoulder.
I'll dance with Nathan, she says. I'll dance with whoever I like.
But what about the desire in your stomach? That you can't help whenever you see him?
If you'd have ever shut up about him, maybe you and I would have got together by now.
In the spirit of exploration? She leans in, puts her head on my chest. I feel her sigh.
I wonder if realizing you're not sure about stuff is what makes you a grown-up.
Lots of adults seem really sure about things.
Maybe they're not grown-up either.
Tell that to my mother.
Tell that to mine.
We dance. It's nice. Just think, Jared says, handing me a cup of punch. Yep, punch. In a cup. This could be our last party without alcohol ever. We're not 21 for 3 more years, I say. I look around to Henna, now fast dancing with Nathan in a group with Mel and Call Me Steve. And none of us are big drinkers.
More a metaphor for making our own choices, Jared says.
And why don't any of us drink? Then he glances at me, thinking of my father and the rehab story. Oh, sorry. I shrug and drink my punch.
How's the medication going? He asks me, lowering his voice.
I shrug again. Takes a while to work, and there's a lot of talking to Dr. Luther that goes along with it. Feeling okay, though.
That's good, he says.
Do you like yourself, Jared?
He looks at me, surprised. I know he guesses exactly why I'm asking.
Sometimes, he says. Sometimes not.
Sometimes not, I repeat. Those things going on. Those things you can't talk about.
Jared turns to me. We haven't danced enough.
Together?
All of us together. He cocks his head to our friends, dancing in the crowd, smiling, working up a sweat. Laughing, dancing like fools. The hall is packed now, probably for the same reason as the restaurant.
People know something's going on and just want to be together. I have a flash of terror that this would be a great opportunity to blow a whole lot of people up again. If there are any gas mains running below the school, that is.
What is it? Jared asks.
What if we're in danger here? I say, feeling my chest contract, feeling suddenly desperate. Like I need to find a loop, quickly, one that will save us all from being blown up.
Do you see any indie kids?
Jared asks. I look around. He's right. There's not one. Which makes me sort of sad, really.
We'll be fine, he says, dragging me out onto the dance floor.
Maybe we should check outside, I say, but my words are lost in the volume of the music and the crush of people suddenly around us. We join Henna, Mel, Steve, and Nathan, and we dance. It's nice, too.
We're going to take off, Mel says about an hour later.
We're all standing in the rest area where the school has put out a bunch of couches just slightly too brightly lit to encourage heavy kissing.
We'll meet you at the cabin.
Now, you're sure we're not going to be ritualistically murdered? Call Me Steve says, actually looking a bit nervous. Prom night? Group of diverse teens? Remote cabin?
Mel blinks. Are you being serious?
I'm a doctor. We see stuff. There have been strange things going down.
We all just stare at him.
What?
That's not the story that's happening, Mel says to him. We're not the kind of people that story happens to.
What? I don't...
She kisses him.
I love that you're worried, she says, but you're worried about the wrong things.
Is all he says because she's already dragging him away. She waves goodbye. Call Me Steve is driving her to our place. They're going to change, then she'll get the clothes we all packed and bring his car and hers out to the cabin. So we've got an extra there after the Hummer drops the rest of us off. Jared and his dad left Jared's car out there today, too. It's a whole plan.
You guys ready to go? I ask Henna and Jared.
I think I'm done, Henna says. My arm is starting to hurt from all my phenomenal choreography.
She looks to the dance floor.
Nathan's still out there, though.
And he is,
just kind of dancing on his own with a cup of punch. Seriously, a cup of punch. It's embarrassing. I guess he's making one of those memories to take with him.